This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission scheduled for May 4th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The Federal Election Commission open meeting for Thursday, May 4th, 2006 will come to order. Before we begin our agenda for this morning, just want to announce that the Commission has released a draft advisory opinion that we're going to consider on an expedited process involving the campaign to elect Nancy Deddert, who is a candidate in Florida, who was the unfortunate victim of embezzlement from her campaign treasurer. And the Commission released the advisory opinion request on April 28th, and this morning we have released, within the last couple of hours, released a draft advisory opinion that we're going to be considering on tally on Monday, May 8th, and we'll be accepting comments, as is the norm, over the next several days. But by doing this on an expedited process and doing it on tally, it'll allow us to take action on this advisory opinion in a shorter period of time than is the norm. Because normally we consider advisory opinions in our open meetings. But we thought it was appropriate in this circumstance and perhaps in others to consider advisory opinions on an expedited basis when they are time sensitive and involve pressing circumstances for candidates such as this one. And we're looking at a process where advisory opinions of this nature that have unanimous support of all the commissioners be considered in this fashion. And this is the first one where we're doing this. We've just issued a release that details a little bit more this case, but wanted to announce that Monday we're planning to vote on tally in that advisory opinion. And so with that, we'll turn to our agenda for this morning. The first item of business, correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the consideration and approval of the minutes for April 20th, 2006, as set forth in Agenda Document 06-34.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0. Second item of business this morning is two advisory opinions. We were originally going to begin with Advisory Opinion 2006-8 on behalf of Matthew Brooks. We have received a comment submitted by counsel, and we are looking at that comment now. So we're going to take that up at the end of the agenda today rather than at the beginning, so we have a bit of time to review that comment. So we will next go to Advisory Opinion 2006-13. On behalf of Dennis Spivak and Neil Reif is the counsel, and Mr. John Levin from the counsel's office is handling this matter, and I think we have a late submitted – no, we do not have a late submitted document on this. Okay, great. Mr. Levin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The draft before you responds to an advisory opinion request from counsel for Dennis Spivak, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the at-large seat in the U.S. House of Representatives from Delaware. Mr. Spivak is, and has been since 2001, an equity partner at the Morris James Law Firm and has been compensated in accordance with the firm's established compensation plan. He anticipates that during this year, he will devote a considerable amount of time to campaigning, and hence his productivity at the firm will likely be reduced from previous years. The firm's compensation plan takes reduced productivity into account. Mr. Spivak asks whether the compensation paid by the firm, in accordance with the firm's established compensation plan, will constitute a contribution to his campaign. The draft concludes that it will not constitute a contribution because Mr. Spivak's compensation, one, will result from bona fide employment that is genuinely independent of his candidacy, two, will be exclusively in consideration of services provided by him as part of his employment, and three, will not exceed the compensation that would be paid to any similarly qualified person for the same work over the same period of time. And I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Discussion on the draft advisory opinion. Is there a motion? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I was going to move for the adoption of the staff document, which make sure I've got my number right here, is agenda item 06-36.
Vice Chairman has moved approval of agenda document number 06-36. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes by a vote of 6-0, and the advisory opinion is approved. Thank you, Mr. Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our next item of business this morning is a report from the Audit Division concerning the New Democratic Network. We have Erica Lee, Marty Faven, and Joseph Stoltz from the Audit Division, and Delaney Painter from the Office of General Counsel on this matter. And Mr. Stoltz, would you and your team like to start first? Is that how we're going to?
That's
okay,
you.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Stoltz.
Good morning. The objection that placed us on the agenda revolves around an event that, or a series of events, actually. There's only one of them that's really in question, that this committee sponsored, and how it should be classified, whether it is a fundraising event, in which case the expenses would be allocated based on the relative federal, non-federal contributions received. And in this particular case, all of the money that was raised in connection with this particular event was deposited in a non-federal account. Or whether it is part of the committee's administrative costs and was not a fundraising event, although there were fees and things and membership solicitations made. It was a three-day gathering, and the invitations and so forth that go with it suggest that it was a discussion, workshop kind of thing that dealt with both federal and non-federal issues. We have classified it as an administrative expense of the committee and done the allocations accordingly. The committee argues that it was a fundraising event. In the end, dollars and cents wise, it makes little difference because we don't wind up with a non-federal overfunding regardless of how it's classified. It's more a question of what needed to be disclosed with respect to the event. If it is strictly a non-federal fundraiser, then the expenses don't have to be disclosed. If it is an administrative event, then disclosure would follow. All of the other administrative type costs should have been paid from the federal account and a share reimbursed from the non-federal account.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. Does the counsel's office have any thoughts as we consider this? Okay. And we had two objections here, one from the vice chairman and one from myself. I'll just say a couple things perhaps at the outset. I had no problem with recommendations 1 through 3 in the report. As Mr. Stoltz indicated, the issue solely concerns recommendation number 4. And I agree that in terms of the case here, however we come out on this is not going to make a significant difference dollars-wise because, as I understand it, the committee chose to pay for a portion of this event with federal dollars. But I do think it's an important legal principle in terms of how we apply the funds received methodology and how we determine whether a fundraising event is a fundraising event versus another type of event. And I should note, and I apologize for not noting this at the outset, that Commissioner Weintraub is recused from this matter. So she is among the audience for this discussion. But I think it is an important legal question in terms of how we determine what type of events are fundraising events and therefore are governed by the funds received methodology and what types are not and therefore are subject to the administrative split. And I understand that there has been some history of this at the agency over the years, which I was fortunate enough or not fortunate enough to not be a part of, depending upon how you look at that history. But in my view, there's a couple of key things that govern my thoughts in this area. First, as I read the regulations, fundraising events that raise money are governed entirely by the funds received methodology. And as Mr. Stoltz indicated, under that traditional approach, you really look to the type of money that's raised. And if it's all hard money, then the event must be paid for solely with federal dollars. If it's all soft money, then it can be paid pay for entirely with soft money, and if it's a mixture, then you follow the exact proportion in terms of the monies raised. And in the regulations, I really don't see a basis for the agency having discretion to decide that certain fundraising events really aren't fundraising events, either because they don't raise a lot of money or perhaps because they're longer than a couple of hours or even a day. As I see the regulations, if you have an event at which money is banked, that's a fundraising event, and you're in the funds received methodology, and that's what governs how you can pay for the event. And so in that respect, the language on page 11 of the report, that sort of the bottom of the page, and there's the last full paragraph there, says the fact that the funds received from this event were deposited only into the non-federal account is irrelevant when determining whether a disbursement is allocable. And I have a slightly different take on that, because I do think it's relevant in terms of the accounts into which the monies are deposited, and in fact I think it's dispositive. Even if an event lasts more than one day, and regardless of how much money is raised. Because if we don't take that position, we're basically saying that we're going to reserve the ability to determine for ourselves whether a fundraising event really is a fundraising event. And I just don't see a basis for doing that in the regulations. The other thing that concerned me was some of the criteria that I mentioned on page 10 of the draft audit report for the argument that there were aspects of this event that were federal in nature. And so the bullet points on the top of page 10 indicating that a speech was given by Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. For me, that really isn't relevant because certainly this event, which predated BCRA, federal candidates could raise soft money for a wide variety of purposes, and that didn't mean it was a federal event. Again, for me anyway, what governs is what type of money is raised at the event. And then the bullet point that talks about the solicitation indicates that it will feature more than 20 members of Congress, discussions on top issues facing policymakers in Washington, and an overview of national politics. I didn't think that was really made a difference one way or the other, because the type of money raised, for me, governs how the event costs need to be paid for. So I mean, I think the reason I objected is because I thought it was important that we have a discussion on this, and I think Mr. Stoltz is absolutely right. This particular event, because the NDN chose to pay for a portion of this event out of hard money, it really doesn't make a lot of difference in their world how we treat this event, but it will make a difference for a lot of other organizations. And from my view is that when it's a fundraising event, no matter how much money is raised, organizations such as this are entitled to rely on the funds received methodology, and that should govern how they pay for these kinds of event costs. They could always choose to pay some federal money for these kinds of costs, but wouldn't be required to use any federal money when only soft money is being raised. So I objected with respect to that issue. And Mr. Vice Chairman, you also lodged an objection.
I did, for the same reasons, in addition to the points you've raised, I guess the other sort of part of the analysis is I looked back on our audit many years ago with the Michigan Republican Party is the question whether any of these disbursements were in connection with a federal election, and I really didn't see anything here that reflected that they were. The best we can do is that there were federal officials, members of Congress, who attended, although as the chairman notes, we highlight in the audit report the presence of Senator Clinton, who was then, I believe, 5 years away from her election. And the issues that were discussed were sort of broad. The federal issues that were discussed were broad issues of policy related to the state of the federal of the national economy and the role of terrorism in the future of the nation. And this was an event with state candidates and our state office holders present as well, raising state-specific issues. So I don't see here anything that would lead us to conclude that the funds received method is inappropriate. This certainly was a fundraising event. They were soliciting contributions from people to attend this event, and the funds received were placed in a state political account. I my concerns with this I share the concerns that you've raised.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Discussion on the audit report before us. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, I voted initially to approve this, but I have to say that listening to the arguments from the chairman and the vice chairman, and frankly going back and taking a closer look at the regulation, actually convinced me that I voted incorrectly on this. And I it seems to me we put ourselves in a very strange position if we are going to have to judge rather than based on the fundraising principle and where the monies are placed to see whether this is a fundraiser or not. If we're putting ourselves in a position of saying, well, you know, we're going to have to determine whether it's a fundraiser or not depending on how many speakers they had. Well, if they had only two federal speakers and 10 state speakers, well, then it'll count as a fundraiser. But no, if they had more federal... It just puts us in this strange position of trying to judge, well, how much policy speech-making is okay and how much is not, which I think is not a very good idea. I also don't believe that the presence of federal officials automatically brings it within the federal realm, because having many, many years ago been a local county party chairman and having to try to raise money for county commission races, it's much easier to raise money for federal races than it is for local races, because people don't want to give money for that. And the way local parties are able to raise money is they organize events where they bring in their congressmen, because people want to hear from their congressmen, and that's how you get people to events. That's how you actually can raise money for local and state elections. So I've been convinced by these arguments and taking a look back at it, and I actually would like to change my vote from approval to an objection. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Further discussion on the audit report before us? Commissioner Mason.
Well, I had shared with a couple of my colleagues my experience immediately prior to being on the Federal Election Commission, where I worked for a large nonprofit organization which did fundraising all the time. Fortunately, the fundraising wasn't my job. But we did do multi-day events that were fundraising events, and they were actually set up in a way quite similar to the way these events appear to run, which is to say that people were not charged large fees to go to these events, but if you hadn't already given $10,000 or some large sum, you didn't get invited. And if you had in fact already given your $10,000, well, you got an invitation and you could come to this event, and it might only cost you a few hundred dollars, but it was several days and there were policy discussions and so on like that. And in the context of that organization, which I don't think was at all atypical, it would have been kind of a joke to claim that this was an educational program of the foundation, which in fact was what the group's operations were on, and would have been looked at by the Better Business Bureau and perhaps by the IRS as a misrepresentation of what was going on, because essentially what was going on was what's sometimes called donor maintenance. And it strikes me that the question in a context such as this would be more that not whether this was a fundraiser or not, or fund, you know, donor maintenance, or you know, something clearly related to fundraising, but rather whether the nature of it, which where this event was not intended to create a large profit, but in fact was to further their overall relations with the donors, which then would extend to both their federal and non-federal solicitations. You know, could we somehow look at that and reach out and say, well, in fact, this was related to their overall operations? I'm not at all sure that we can in a reliable way, but I think there is a bit of a live question. The other question I want to raise is exactly how far we would take this if we reject this recommendation and replace it with a conclusion that, okay, if you charge the event and the fees related to the event went into your non-federal account, your event costs are non-federal, the event or the series of events that the audit division compared this to were the Michigan Republican Party's Mackinac Island conferences, which I think had that committee before us for three successive audits. And part of the problem there was that under Michigan law, there was a separate category for those type of events, and it was sort of the equivalent of state soft money. And I think the party took the position, well, if the state thinks it's soft money, then of course the feds will too. And the commission decided that we weren't bound by the Michigan statute, and in fact had to enforce our own statute and regulations. Those events, as I recall, were not fundraising events. In other words, I don't recall if there were admissions fees charged or not, but the party anyway didn't say that. But the question it sort of raises is, okay, for parties or other groups that are in a situation like that, that have a big event, would a ruling such as this allow them to recharacterize it by simply changing the structure a little bit and charging people, $100 a head or $10 a head to get in to a multi-day conference, the bulk of which is funded by fees by, attendees. And in the case of the Mackinac Conference, the funding was not significantly by the party rank and file who were there, but rather was by interest groups who wanted to be there with both the federal and the state officials who were participating. And so that could become a significant issue for state parties, and I just want to highlight that because I don't know how, if we sort of take this per se rule of, okay, you charged a price to get in, you deposited the receipts into your non-federal account, sort of end of discussion, I don't see how we could prevent a state party from taking an event such as the Mackinac event and recharacterizing it in this way.
Vice Chairman Linhart.
Yeah, I wasn't sure we'd gone that far because my recollection from my review of the records in that case, I wasn't here then, was that there was a lot of indications that the conference was in connection with a federal election. My impression, they certainly had all of the candidates for the presidency there and held what I believe the FEC characterizes as a beauty contest of all the presidential candidates. They were explicitly discussing federal races, and there was a period of the conference devoted to attacking the incumbent Democratic office holder and supporting the Republican challenger who was present at the conference as well. And so there were my sense was that there were other things going on there that made that clearer, that it was in connection with a federal election, that those activities were in connection with a federal election that were a far cry from what we're seeing before us in this case.
Commissioner Mason.
I vigorously disagree. And the audit division went through exactly that. I mean, what you had here was the person who is and probably was then the leading contender for the Democratic presidential nomination. And Senator Clinton, won't say she's running, and she may not intend to run, but
nobody's running right now.
I understand, but I mean,
we're all worried on the midterm.
But in terms of this organization's interest, the day she was elected senator, she was a notable possibility to be presidential nominee, and there were these other federal candidates there, and the audit division went through and discussed how this had discussed federal races and so on, and so there may have been in some of those years, and remember we went through three cycles with the Michigan Committee, and yes, in the presidential cycle there was much more of a focus on the presidential candidates in the Michigan caucuses, but not always, and so the difference was at most merely one of degree, and that is you had federal candidates there at the Mackinac Conference, you also had state candidates, and in certain years the federal component weighed more, but here we clearly had federal candidates here, and we had discussions of federal races. And I'll bet you if we have transcripts, you had criticism of Republican incumbents. And that's why I'm saying it looks to me as if we go this route, we're pretty much taking a per se rule. And if we're not, then frankly, I think we would need to go back and do the sort of analysis the auditors did and say, okay, how many events were there and what was the agenda of the event and so on. And I agree that's problematic, by the way, but that's why I just wanted to highlight this, because I do think these were actually quite close to the Mackinac conferences in character in terms of what went on at the events, and the differences really were simply ones of degree, perhaps, but not ones that we could draw the sort of firm distinctions on. Or if we're trying to, that's what I wanted to draw out. Okay, so what would they be And if, in fact, we're not drawing a per se rule, and rather we're saying, well, if the person's actually a candidate when they show up, is that the basis? Well, of course, you know, these members of Congress were all candidates at the time they showed up, or what is the basis of how we're going to examine these events, because the auditors need to know and the respondent committees need to know.
A couple things. First, I'm sure the Mackinac Island officials are glad they aren't going through a fourth audit process. As charming as your team is, Mr. Stoltz, I'm sure they think three times is more than enough. I think Commissioner Mason makes a number of good points in terms of the issues here. And for me, my view is that I don't see any basis in the regulations for us to parse through a fundraising event and determine whether or not there was enough money raised or the bar was set high enough that it's truly a fundraising event and determine that some events are truly fundraising events and therefore can be paid for on the funds received methodology, whereas other events really aren't fundraising events, even though some money is being collected and therefore need to be paid on the administrative split. It may make some policy sense to go down that road, and I'm not saying that that would be an irrational analysis. I just don't see a basis for it in the regulations. Reviewing the regulations in the E&J, I don't see any indication that the commission was saying, look, to be a fundraising event, you've got to net a certain amount or you've got to be at a certain dollar level or anything of that nature, nor do I see any indication in the E&J that we were focusing on who was attending these types of fundraising events, who was speaking at them. You know, are they federal candidates, are they non-federal candidates, that kind of thing. Just from my standpoint, and unless we amend the regulations in this area, my view is if money is banked, if money is collected, it's a fundraising event and can be paid for in that manner. Of course, if they're raising hard money at that kind of an event, then they're going to have to pay for that portion of the event with hard money, which I think is the safeguard that's in there in the regulations and works that way. So I guess my response would be, I think Commissioner Mason raises very good points, and we need to provide guidance to our audit team in terms of our position here. My position is that it really is a per se rule. If you're raising money, it's a fundraising event. You follow the funds received methodology. End of story. Vice Chairman Lenhart.
Yeah, I was going to. I guess I just wanted to disagree with Commissioner Mason, because I do find the facts here significantly different. And in determining that, in concluding that this is in connection with the federal election, on page 10, the audit points to several different factors. One was that in the prior year they had allocated the costs based upon the funds received. In the prior years, they had in fact deposited some funds in their federal account, and so we conclude that past practice leads us to believe that this was in connection with a federal election. The second was that 20 members of Congress arrived and there were discussions of issues facing policymakers in Washington, which included challenges to the economy, trends in the global media, terrorism, and the national political landscape. The fourth factor we consider is that the home state senator the location of this event, Senator Clinton, gave a speech. At this point, this was in April of 2002, which I find hard to believe was truly in preparation for a presidential race in 2008. And finally, there were panels that discussed the candidates that this organization supported, although that's not clearly presented on the agenda. Looking at those factors as the basis for our conclusion that these expenditures were made in connection with the federal election and therefore administrative costs, although they were all event specific, does not strike me as a supportable conclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
But I'm just trying to get an understanding. I mean, one of the issues at Mackinac was that we were able to rely on press accounts of exactly what was said in the speeches, which I know in other contexts the Vice Chairman has sometimes worried a bit about, in essence, that we do become the speech police. And if it's on that sort of basis, we have a fairly sketchy description, and in fact, I suspect most of the events were closed to the press. And my suggestion is if the distinction between this and Mackinac, I mean, the Mackinac events could have been described in ways similar to this absent the news stories that were associated with them. Now, of course, the party seemed to want the news coverage, so Maybe they pay a penalty for that. But if the question is the connection with federal races, I don't know how, based on what the vice chairman has said, we would avoid a more searching inquiry into what was said. Because I'm fairly confident that if you sat through those sessions, there would have been a fair amount of pointed electoral discussion. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But that's the area. I just want to point out that that's the area the vice chairman is sending us into, is that we would have to say, you know, not only look at the panels and who was on the panels, but what was said. In other words, it seems to be the distinction between NDN as its representatives. Well, the panels were about issues, and even though there were federal candidates there, it was an issue discussion, and so that makes it okay to be a fundraiser. But at Mackinac, we know they actually talked about elections, and so that changes it. And that's my question, is what's our standard, and then how are we going to police that standard, and are we going to set up a standard that's going to require us to have a transcript of the event before we can make a distinction between whether it was a fundraising event or an overhead administrative cost. And I don't think that's a tenable way to make that distinction, and that's why I'm raising the issue.
I think we'll have no choice but to go to Mackinac Island next summer and assess that event for ourselves. I understand it's lovely there in July. Two quick points. I think Commissioner Mason outlined sort of the pros and cons of different approaches. Under the approach I'm advocating, there would be no searching inquiry because you would focus solely on the types of funds raised and whatever that is. If it's all hard, then the event has to be paid for out of hard money. If it's all soft, then it can be paid for out of soft, and it wouldn't matter in terms of who's attending and how the panels are structured and that kind of thing. Further discussion on the issues before us today.
Commissioner Wolf. General Counsel's comment on some of the debate that's taken on. I'm concerned about Commissioner Mason's issues, and I'd like to just get some thought on where you stand on the debate.
Our able counsel's office, Mr. Norton.
Comments on the debate? So you just say who's won the debate?
Mr. Norton.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Well, I would say thank you, Commissioner Walter, but I'm really not feeling grateful. I don't really actually have a whole lot to add. I think I do agree with Commissioner Toner that I think the regulation settles the matter. The only other point I would make, and while it doesn't directly apply here, I think it's worth noting, is the regulation in 100.24 where the commission was addressing federal election activity and specifically crafted an exception in... I'm going to have trouble citing the provision, but it's towards the very end of the regulation where it identifies exceptions, and one of them is the commission was specifically addressing amounts expended or disbursed by a state, district, or local committee of a political party, and one of the exceptions for federal election activity is the cost of a state, district, or local political convention, meeting, or conference. I think it's worth noting, although it's not the controlling regulation. I think the controlling regulation takes you to the place where the commission appears to be.
Thank you, Mr. Norton.
Wasn't that bad?
Further discussion on the audit report before us. And Commissioner Wolfer.
I'm prepared. I wouldn't say I'm prepared to call it a per se rule forever, but in this particular case, I'm comfortable with withdrawing my objection and also not, but and supporting your position on this. Originally, I approved it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, do we have a motion? Do we want to offer a motion on handling this? And since I'm barred from offering one, then I open the floor to my colleagues. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Well, I'm profoundly tempted to continue going around and around with Commissioner Mason. I think I will draw this all to a close because I don't think he's fairly characterized at all what I'm saying. But we'll leave that for another day. I would like to make a motion to adopt the audit recommendations as to finding 1, 2, and 3, and to strike finding number 4 in the audit of the New Democratic Network, which is, I believe, agenda document 06-35.
The Vice Chairman has moved to adopt findings numbers 1 through 3 in agenda document number 06-35 concerning the audit report of the New Democratic Network and to strike finding number 4. Discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion. Mr. Stoltz.
Traditionally, what the Commission has done in these sorts of situations is rather than strike a finding, what we would do is explain the Commission's conclusions with respect to the finding, and the finding would remain in the report. Among other things, it then tells the reader how the Commission concluded, as opposed to having it just sort of disappear from the report.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, and we have done that only recently. I'm not inclined to do that in this circumstance. I mean, in part because I think going back and try that there is consensus that we don't agree with this analysis. It's not clear to me that easily or quickly we can come to complete agreement on how to phrase what our analysis is. And similarly, there's a great deal in this report that ends up, you know, supporting a conclusion that we don't, I think, as after we voted, we're not going to agree with. And so I guess my sense in this particular case is that it would be clearer and easier and less confusing and quicker simply to delete this particular finding.
Mr. Costa.
That would certainly establish a new precedent for the agency. Obviously, that's up to the Commission to make that determination. The Audit Division has always proceeded on the basis that we make findings in our audit reports to the Commission. The Commission deliberates over those findings and then makes decisions based on that. And where a finding is not adopted by the Commission, we so state that, to the point where we will add whatever the Commission wishes to the substance of the report in order not to misinform the public. That's our opinion on it. That is the standard that we follow, the reporting, the standard that is required of an auditor. So in our view, we would strongly support a Commission determination to add language to this body of this report that explains in detail, as much detail as you wish, what the decision was the Commission made when it made it.
Thank you, Mr. Costa. I'm sorry, is anybody seeking recognition there? No. Okay, great. A couple points. I have to say I'm inclined to support the Vice Chairman's approach. And to be honest with you, I prefer to have this discussion not in a public meeting, but we are told legally that we must have this kind of discussion in a public meeting, and it's not ideal. But the reason I'm inclined to support the Vice Chairman's motion is that whatever the view of the agency is in terms of audit reports is the agency acting as a whole. And to have a situation where you have proposed findings put out in a public document that either can be adopted or rejected or modified suggests that there's an independent operation here apart from the commissioners and the agency, and I have a problem with that. I think that we collectively do our work and review the regulations and review for all the work product here in terms of the various divisions. And I have difficulty with a situation where you have a proposal and then if commissioners have a different take on it, their option is to basically have that noted in the record. I don't think that's an unreasonable way of proceeding. I understand we have proceeded that way a long time, but I have to say I don't think it's as preferable as coming to a collective decision on how we view the regulations and how we view the legal issues, and then whatever that decision is, have that be reflected in the document. It is how we handle things in other areas, for example, in advisory opinions and obviously in regulations. And I understand every area is different, but I do think that's more seamless. But I have to say I would have preferred to have this kind of discussion in private, and I recognize that these are strongly held views in terms of these issues, but I have to say that is my view. And I think it would be vastly preferable to proceed in the manner in which the Vice Chairman has indicated. Further discussion on the motion. Commissioner Mason.
Well, I have two views again. First, let me make an observation about the privacy. It doesn't bother me to discuss the particulars of this in public or the policy. In fact, I think there's great value to it because one of the things that concerns me is that we be clear about the policies we're adopting, the basis for those policies, and the implications for other committees. And so I think one of the most I think we're all in agreement that this issue is of virtually no importance whatsoever as applies to the New Democrat Network. And so if
I should say that the discomfort I had in terms of talking about this in public was not the substance of the issue. It's how we're handling what we're going to do with these documents.
That doesn't bother me either. But
that's fair enough.
The chairman,
it does, because I think these things are tough issues to work through institutionally.
But if we dispose of this report on an issue that's of little consequence here, I am very concerned about the implications of that and you know where we you know what it implies elsewhere and in terms of how we operate. I do not want to come out with an outcome that could have a significant effect on the way state party committees and other committees that allocate funds are permitted to allocate, but be unclear about what the basis of it was or the implications. And so simply striking the report and making it go away striking the finding and making it go away with no explanation, I think is a very bad outcome, because exactly the issues I've raised where commissioners may differ, then the next time the auditors go into the field, what standard do they use? And for the state party committees or non-authorized committees such as NDN who are holding events, what standard do they use? We've got a duty to inform them. In terms of the audit, findings and rejections, I know the auditors feel very strongly about that. I understand. I'm a little less bothered because, as I understand it, their source of that is the standards for government auditors, which essentially say that auditors have an obligation to put forth findings that they view as material. But one of the things that same standard says is that auditors should be cautious about the fact that they're not the ultimate judges or policymakers in those. And so it strikes me that the distinction between this commission's audits and audits by, say, an inspector general or by an independent auditing agency is the auditing function and the policy function is merged. And it's right here. And so I don't think, and because of that, and because the commission is in a position to make a policy determination, it strikes me that if the commission makes a policy determination which obviates the need for a finding, we ought to explain that, but it doesn't strike me that simply taking out the finding and discussing the policy is some kind of a violation of the auditing standards. Because we have that policy answer right here with us, but I think we do have an obligation to state the policy basis, and I would not support a motion that would leave us taking this finding out and not explaining why.
I think Commissioner Mason makes a number of good points in terms of the audit function versus the policy or the legal interpretation function. I actually was planning to offer a statement for the record that indicate my view on this issue, similar to when we do not adopt a general counsel's report in the enforcement side, a statement for the record that lay out the basis for my view in terms of this area of the law, and then however many people wanted to join me would be obviously their decision. And I agree with the Commissioner Mason that it's important for us internally and externally to clearly indicate our view of the law and how we ought to approach these issues and how we want our audit team to approach these issues. I agree completely with that. My biggest concern about the way we've done this historically is that you have sort of two voices in the report, one from the audit team, and then if it's those recommendations are not adopted, a second voice in terms of commissioners. And I'm just uncomfortable with that because there's a dissonance when you have that kind of a process. I'd prefer to speak with one voice when we are able to reach consensus on these kinds of issues. But I agree with Commissioner Mason wholeheartedly that we have an obligation to state clearly what our position is, and I actually was planning to offer a statement for the record on this particular issue and see how many people wanted to join on that, and sort of similar to how we do statements of reasons in the enforcement side, which I would hope would serve that kind of function. Further discussion. Commissioner Wolf.
I'm wondering if it seems to me we're talking about a matter of methodology and departing from a procedure that we've had over the period of time and not amending the audit report, but rather not agreeing with it and stating our reasons why we don't agree and going forward with it that way. And that's really not an issue for which recusal makes a difference here. It's how we do business ourselves. And I was wondering if we might invite Commissioner Weintraub to participate and vote on the methodology issue.
You mean in terms of the institutional issue of how
the institutional issue of how we deal with that?
Mr. General Counsel.
I don't mean to cut you off.
Sure,
General,
no,
if you want
please,
to.
Please. By all means.
Well, I think Commissioner Walther raises a good point. I think that we are talking about is a the Commission could certainly do that, do what it wants to do on a case-by-case basis, but I think we're talking about a departure from longstanding policy. I see no reason, you know, why the full commission couldn't participate in that. And frankly, you know, while if there's consensus and you want to make a decision about this today, that's certainly fine. I don't see any reason why this particular question couldn't be reserved for later with an opportunity to reflect a little more on it. And it does very much concern internal policies and could, without question, be discussed in executive session. And so, I mean, again, it's the Commission's prerogative to discuss it in open session. And, of course, if there's consensus, there's no bar to deciding it today. But I think, in particular, Commissioner Walther's point about Commissioner Weintraub is a good one.
I only say that because going forward, it seems to me that this is of concern to a lot the commissioners and staff as well, and I'm not inclined to depart from the longstanding tradition of that more thought and debate today. And I'd be interested to hear what Commissioner Weintraub has to say and, as part of the overall debate on methodology.
Okay, why don't we do this? When in doubt, take a five-minute break. Let's think through during the break about how we want to approach this matter and also, you know, if we want to think institutionally in a broader sense, do we want to do that in an executive session? Let's take a five-minute break and we'll reconvene. Okay. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Okay, back on the record. I think what we're going to do is we'll hold over this audit report of the New Democratic Network, and we will do some more thinking internally in terms of the institutional questions of how to handle findings of the audit reports that may or may not be adopted by the Commission. And then once we've made that decision, we'll be able to implement it in this audit report as well as others. So I think we've gotten the issues out on the table, and we'll plan to do that and then take this matter back up in the coming weeks. If there's no objection, we'll plan to proceed in that manner. And that takes us to our final item of business, which is Advisory Opinion 2006-8 on behalf of Mr. Matthew Brooks and Craig Engel as counsel. We're going to take, I think, a 30-minute break because we received a comment from Mr. Engel, and we want to make sure we have a chance to digest it and consider it. So we will plan to reconvene at 11:50 this morning, 10 of 12. Thank you. Okay, let's resume. This is a continuation of the Federal Election Commission's open meeting of Thursday, May 4th. And our last item of business today is Advisory Opinion 2006-8, submitted by Matthew Brooks and his counsel, Craig Engel. And I think we have a late-submitted document, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider Agenda Document 06-37.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion passes by a vote of 6-0. And from the counsel's office in this matter, Daniel Abramson, as well as Rosie Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the agenda before you is Draft Advisory Opinion 2006-08, responding to an advisory opinion request by Mr. Matthew Brooks. This draft reflects the additional information that was provided by Mr. Brooks at the request of the Commission during its meeting on April 20th. Mr. Brooks intends to form a for-profit corporation to provide commercial services to individuals interested in making contributions to political committees, candidates, and other entities. Mr. Brooks inquires as to the permissibility of the corporation's plan to receive deposits from individuals and then, at the individual's direction, distribute these funds to the proper recipients. The request also asks whether it is permissible for the corporation to provide commentary and analysis of federal candidates to its customers, as well as forward solicitations from candidates and committees to its customers. The draft concludes that the corporation may receive funds and distribute contributions to candidates and political committees. The corporation may also forward commentary and analysis of federal candidates to its customers. However, the corporation may not forward solicitations for federal candidates or political committees. And we do have a few technical amendments to the draft. On page 7, footnote 3, these changes change the incorrect plural possessives to singular possessives and correct the citation. The correct sentence should read, because the corporation will be forwarding solicitations for political committees other than its own separate segregated fund, the corporation may not avail itself of the narrow exception allowing certain communications outside of its restricted class contained in 2 U.S.C. 441 B.B. 4A.I. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Abramson. And I guess we had a late comment from the Requester's Council, I guess dated May 3rd, which we received this morning. That's my understanding. We have that as well. Okay, discussion of the draft before us today. Commissioner Weintraub, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Good to have you.
Maybe, maybe not. You might not like what I have to say.
It's always good to have you, regardless of what position you take.
That's very gracious of you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank my colleagues and the requester for trying to accommodate my desire to get some more information on exactly how this is going to work. I appreciate the effort. As it turns out, I'm still not entirely clear on the details of how this organization is going to function. And in part because of that, I'm not going to be able to vote for this AO today. But as I said last time, if there are four votes to go forward and answer the man's question, that's without me, that's fine. I think that in AOs, we are really... The process was designed for a very fact-specific analysis, and I don't have those kind of specific facts here. And I think one of the dangers of issuing an AO where we don't have very specific facts is that regardless of what this requester ends up doing, somebody else is going to read the same AO and think, aha, well, if he can do that, then I can do this. And, you know, it's if we're not tying this to a very specific plan on the part of the requester, it's hard to say that they can't. I think they're at some risk if they deviate in any way from what we specifically say here, but it's possible and it concerns me. I think that it's clear that somebody could hire themselves out as a financial advisor to people who want to make political donations. I think you could, you know, clearly have a newsletter or some other form of information. What makes this different is that he wants to actually collect the money and distribute the money. And what's not clear to me still is to what degree the information that he's going to be providing is going to be... could be slanted in order to encourage people to come to the conclusion that certain candidates or causes are worthy of support. The corporation is going to select information that it thinks will be relevant to the requesters based on, and it's still not clear to me exactly how the requesters are going to make their interests known to the corporation. It seems to me there's a lot of discretion involved in this process. And I think if you want to set up an organization to take in money and then to hand out money to candidates and to guide the direction in which that money is going to flow, there is a perfectly legal way of doing that. It's called forming a political committee. And it's just not clear to me that what he's doing shouldn't be governed by the rules that govern political committees, which would include limits on how much money you could take in from individuals and how much money could be given out to particular candidates. We have a recent regulation that defines direct as to guide directly or indirectly, and I think that depending on what kind of information is provided, this corporation could be guiding directly or indirectly where the contributions are going to flow. The corporation is going to have physical control over the money, and it seems to me that these are functions of a political committee, not a corporation. So I'm concerned about not only my lack of understanding of exactly how this organization is going to work, but also how other organizations that might be set up in response to this after they read this advisory opinion might organize themselves and I mean no disrespect to either the requester or his counsel, because I'm you know, they're savvy political professionals, and I'm sure they'll do whatever they think is necessary to abide by the law. But, you know, other people may get into this game too, and I don't think we're giving them very good guidance. I do want to point out that there are a couple of serious limitations in the advisory opinion, which I'm pleased to see, that could have relevance, perhaps more so, again, for other people than for this requester. The advisory opinion, if it's approved, currently says on page 5 that individual subscribers would compensate the corporation as an incidental cost in making contributions. I think there are, you know, we have seen in other instances, and I'm not at all suggesting that this is what this requester has in mind, that there are a lot of people out there who are willing to take advantage of people's ideological and political fervor to try and make a buck. And we've seen things where the money doesn't actually end up in the place that the individual donors actually might have intended, and more of it ends up as compensation to the organizer or corporation, and less of it ends up as actual political donation. And we've also seen instances of out-and-out fraud where people set up fake websites that look like they're designed to capture other people's political donations. And again, I'm not suggesting that this is what this requester is planning on doing, but I think for the benefit of other people who are reading this and might say, oh, well, that looks like a good model for making money, I think it's pretty clear by the use of that word incidental that if an organization were to be set up where more money was going into the pocket of the corporation than was being distributed out to in donations, I think that would pose a really serious problem and is not necessarily what is contemplated by this opinion. I also think there's a very serious yes but on page 7, where the draft says that, yes, the corporation may recruit individuals to serve on its board of directors who may also be officers of political committees. However, if these individuals are acting on behalf of a federal candidate or political party committee while participating on the corporation's board of directors, the corporation might be directly or indirectly established, financed, maintained, or controlled by a federal candidate, office holder, political party committee, and thus subject to applicable limits and prohibitions. Whether individuals are acting on behalf of somebody else, whether they are controlling who's establishing the organization, these are all fact-intensive inquiries. And I think that any entity that sets itself up along this model is going to be subject, it's going to have to go forward very carefully because somebody else could file a complaint and say, hey, you know, you were actually, we know who all these people are on your board, and they're all on the board of some other organization, or they're all on the executive committee of a political party committee, or they're all related in some other way to some candidate, and we think it's established, financed, maintained, and controlled. And if we were to get a complaint like that, it's quite possible that the commission would decide that they couldn't dismiss it without doing some investigation, and those are always unpleasant to be on the receiving end of. So if the commission adopts this, they're giving permission, but the permission is somewhat limited, and I think people would have to go forward with extreme care. So in general, that's why I don't think I can support this request, although it's not clear to me that if I actually knew exactly what was going on, that I might not be able to support the particular business model that the requester wants to do. I still don't have a clear sense of exactly how this is going to work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Vice Chairman Lenhart.
Thank you. I want to begin by thanking the counsel for the requester and their providing us repeatedly and promptly with additional information. I think that was helpful for all of us. I think a lot of time was sort of spent trying to think through the implications of this, because I think in some ways what is being presented here is familiar, and in some ways it's new. And I think that a lot of time was spent trying to sort of envision how specifically this particular thing would work and how things like it would work. A couple of things that struck me as new or emerging is that this is a for-profit entity as opposed to being a non-profit, that it's a means by which to provide and process to people who want to make contributions, informations about candidates and groups that are politically active and doing things like what the donor wants to do. And as there's a proliferation of this kind of activity going on, political activity going on, it's a way for people interested in giving to sort through that. And it's also new because this entity wants to, you know, collect and process the contributions for the donors. In some ways, it's a set of kinds of activities that we're beginning to see emerge in models outside of this one, in which information is being provided to people of a like or common political orientation about candidates that are similar to their belief systems and guiding them to making contributions. I think we're seeing this increasingly on the internet, and our recent internet rulemakings make this permitted a lot of that activity to continue. In those cases, the thing that's sort of different about this, is that the fund, in the cases that I've seen, the situations I've seen on the internet, the entity isn't collecting and processing the payments through. They're connecting the donors to the candidate's webpage, but a number of the other features of this are similar to those kinds of models. The factors that really I thought were important for me in deciding to approve or voting to approve the draft that we've got today is that this entity is entirely funded by donors. This is not a situation where this kind of activity is being subsidized by corporations or labor organizations, but it is driven by the donors. The individuals who are involved in this, who sign up to do this, are choosing the information they're getting, both in terms of the initial decision that they want to participate with this kind of group, and my sense is that these groups will make clear that they have particular approaches to politics that the donors are receptive to, and also because they're surveying donors to try and give donors to get a sense of what the donors are interested in more specifically. Another a crucial feature for me is that the control over the decision as to whether to make a contribution or not lies with the donor. As to when that contribution is made, how much is made, whether to make a contribution or not, remains the donor's decision throughout this entire process, and the donor is free to withdraw their money and cease to participate in this entity. So that, I thought, was important in distinguishing it from a political committee, is that throughout this process the donor retains control of decision-making. And so my sense is, to the degree that people are interested in being more active in making contributions, and that this is a helpful process or means by which they can screen and make those decisions, it seemed to fit within our existing rules and regulations, and I would be supportive of the staff draft to that would approve of that.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Just a couple of quick points from my part. I do share the thoughts the Vice Chairman's outlined. A couple things. I think this is, if we approve the opinion here, it'll be an important development, mainly because we're recognizing that vendors can and do act on behalf of donors. Our regulations are a little bit more concrete in terms of vendors who act on behalf of campaign committees or party committees or PACs or other types of entities. But as the Vice Chairman alluded to, there is a development going on now where brokers and vendors act on behalf of the super wealthy who have the nice problem to have of actually worrying about exceeding a $100,000 aggregate contribution limit. That'd be a very nice problem to have, one I'm not familiar with. But in the charitable world, it's my understanding that oftentimes the super wealthy hire brokers and vendors of this nature to advise them on where to make their charitable contributions. And like this model, the decision making lies entirely with the wealthy donor, and they're just these vendors are serving an important function in terms of gathering information for them, making it possible for the donor to know more about the various charitable options that they have. The only difference here is that this is in a political setting in terms of the political donations that the donor may want to make. So I think if we approve the opinion today, we'd be recognizing that vendors can and do act on behalf of clients that are donors, just like they can and do act on behalf of campaign committees or party committees or PACs or other types of entities. The other thing that's important for me is that by every indication, the entity before us today is a commercial entity that is interested in making money, and if their business model takes off, will make money. And I think that's an important factor in terms of deciding to approve proposals before us today. In looking at Mr. Engel's May 3rd letter, I mean, his first issue is he'd prefer that the text talk about how the corporation will not author any analysis rather than say that they won't create any information, and I personally have no problem with that. It seems to be a little bit of a tighter fit in terms of what they're doing. And then the second issue that Mr. Engel raises is whether or not the answer to question number 4, I guess it is, on page 6, in terms of the corporation. There we go. Question number 4, in terms of the corporation receiving and forwarding contributions, Mr. Engel suggests that rather than saying no, that we ought to apply the same analysis and say yes with respect to that. And as my understanding, the theory would be, look, in forwarding contributions, they would be going to the clients, the donors, who fill out these donor profiles in terms of the types of candidates they're interested in, you know, pro-life candidates, pro-choice candidates, conservatives, Republicans, whatever it may be. It would just be another piece of the information packet that the corporation would be providing to the clients to help them decide whether to make contributions. Now, I'm not operating under any illusion that these type of corporations would. I guess I'm recognizing that if this model is approved, that there might be one or more corporations that focus a little bit more on the conservative type candidates and conservative issues, and maybe there'd be one or more on in terms of progressive issues and candidates. But I think the business model is the same. Just like there are vendors that congregate, you know, whether you're talking about media vendors or fundraising vendors or event vendors, tend to service clients that are either on the right or the left, and that's appropriate for them to do that. I would foresee the same situation here. But what I thought was important in terms of the requester's business model is that the corporation would not be exercising any direction or control in terms of the contributions that are made, would not be filtering out solicitations that would be forwarded, but instead would be a facilitator, would be implementing the donor profile decisions that the donor has made. And so if the donor wants to receive every solicitation from pro-life candidates in the Midwest, well, then that's what they're going to get. Or if they want to make different cuts in terms of the information they receive, they can do that. So I was open to discussion of whether or not we could indicate with respect to question 4 that it would be permissible for the corporation to forward and receive the contributions as the solicitation, subject to the same safeguards that we have with respect to the other issues raised in the opinion. Vice Chairman Linhart.
Yes, if I could just return to those points, because I didn't mention the suggested changes that the requester had made, and I should have. I agree. I mean, I think that the first suggested change, which was to clarify that they could that they were in fact going to be creating some information that was being communicated to their clients, you know, was of necessity how the business would operate, but that they were distinguishing that between authoring analysis, and I that seemed an appropriate distinction, and I was supportive of changing the draft to reflect that. In addition, I don't have. I think their second change is appropriate as well. I mean, this didn't. You know, our original analysis that talked about republication didn't entirely. The concerns that the republication rules raised didn't strike me as particularly applicable in this circumstance. Primarily, those appear in the context of entities subsidizing the costs of campaigns by reprinting the campaign's materials, and in this particular instance, that kind of subsidy isn't occurring here. This is much more akin to the rulemaking we just did on the Internet, where they're simply forwarding on emails, and there's no particular cost to the campaigns or to the entity. And to the degree that there are any costs, the donors that have agreed to sign up for this program are paying for those costs. So those two suggested changes didn't concern me.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Barnes-McCoskey, and then Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Barnes-McCoskey.
Well, since I think I had originally requested another draft of this, I certainly am supportive of the Chairman, the Vice Chairman, and the remarks. I would like to thank the team of lawyers who worked on this, Maya Din, Rosemary Smith, and Daniel Abramson, for the various drafts they did based on the comments and so forth coming back from the commissioners, and we do appreciate that. You know, you all have talked about the details of this from a higher kind of policy standpoint. I want to point out that, you know, one of the problems with government regulation is that it tends to stifle innovation, and we should not interpret our regulations to do that. This is an idea, this kind of service corporation to help donors is something that obviously was not contemplated when this law was passed. It wasn't contemplated when our regulations were passed, and it's not something that violates the law, either the exact language of the law or the spirit of the law, and I don't think it violates our regulations either. It's the kind of innovation that's been going on in the service economy throughout the U.S. The chairman mentioned this is now something that's being done in the charitable donations area, exact same kind of thing. And there's obviously, this is not a political committee. There's no hint or even idea that any kind of corruption is going to occur from doing that. I think it is important that we not stifle these kind of innovative ideas, and I support not only the rewrite, but I also think the changes that were suggested by Mr. Engel are changes that are consistent with the reasoning that we've applied in this other draft, and I fully support them.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think this is going to make much of a difference, but I just wanted to point out, because you use the example of, you know, if you want to support pro-life candidates from the Midwest or whatever, that I was actually surprised. I thought that's the way it would work, and I was surprised to get the response that we got from the requester to one of my questions, saying that the corporation will not solicit statements about the subscriber's stance on a particular issue, and the question was posed in favor of would the donors identify themselves as in favor of tax cuts or against tax cuts. And the answer was no, they're not going to solicit statements about the subscriber's stance on a particular issue. Rather, the subscribers will be informing the corporation of their general interest in particular issues. I'm just sort of not sure. It would make more sense to me the way you put it. I would understand the model better if that's what they said they were doing. I'm not exactly sure how this plays out. And I knew somebody was going to raise the innovation argument, and I would hate to be portrayed as the old fuddy-duddy who, you know, is trying to squelch innovation. As I said, if I felt I had a really clear idea of what was going to happen here, I might well be willing to approve it. But, you know, whether it's whether it complies with the law, whether it's a political committee, whether it's complies with our regulations, these are all legal conclusions. And, you know, I think it's fine if other people are happy to draw those legal conclusions. Personally, I'm not. So, you know, obviously that answers the question. If it's not a political committee, it's not a political committee. I'm just not sure, based on what I know, that is the case. But, you know, it's I can count. I'm losing. But I just, you know, again, on the stance versus issue, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but that's what they said anyway.
I think you make a very good point that maybe the donor profiles are of more general nature as opposed to the specific issue subdomains, and but I think you make a good point. They may be operating on a bit of a broader level, although I wouldn't see anything in the opinion that would bar them from having more specific issue dimensions and having people get into the nitty-gritty a little bit. But I think that's a very good point in terms of what's been provided to us by the requester. Further discussion on the issues before us? Commissioner Walther.
early on I mentioned that I hate to see a Commissioner Weintraub go down in flames. So I'm going to join her on this. I have the same basic concerns, and some a little bit different, but it seems to me that this is a loose framework for areas where I'm not sure we are prepared to go. I feel that a lot of this will be, if you're acquiring money, somebody else's money, that places a different obligation on you. It's a fiduciary obligation, and what do you do with this money? And what you help somebody do with this money is a very different thing. And I'm concerned about how the misunderstanding that can occur when you give somebody some money and say, I'm pro-life, and they come back and I don't know how it might work in a given case, but there's potential for saying, well, this person's pro-life, but this person's not going to lose, but we're going to send some money that direction anyhow, or maybe the person may be pro-life, but there's a number of other issues this person has that the person may not really want to have the money spent for. So I'm not sure how they would accurately portray a person or how they would actually want to have that money spent. And I'm also concerned about the profit motive, where the money would come from. Now, if you hold somebody's money and suppose there's a couple hundred thousand or $1 million all together in a fund, how is that going to be invested? Where is the interest going to go? Who's going to keep control of salaries? The subscribers, in theory, won't have any right toward governance or electing people. You have people who are officers on political committees who will have a bent to see where that money goes. And if you have a 10-person committee and you have 500 people out there, there may be a whole slug of issues out there that, they really don't, they think they're getting covered or not, but I think there's such a potential for misunderstanding when you're using somebody else's money that it concerns me on this fairly loose approach to go forward today. And so basically for those reasons, I guess we could take more time and try and develop a envelope that people could fit in, but that based on this, I'm concerned about going forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Further discussion of the issues? So we have a motion. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I will make a motion that we approve agenda document number 06-37, however, with certain amendments, the first of which is that on page 4, line 15, we change the word create to author. And then on page 6 and page 7, I would like to make conforming changes to fit within the second point raised in the response from the requester here. I don't have exact language on how to do that, but I'm wondering if the counsel's office might have language to propose, perhaps taking the footnote up into the, getting rid of the answer as is and taking the footnote number 4 up and changing the language slightly to fit along the lines we've discussed.
What we could do, if people are amenable, is, and if the motion carries, is if question 4 is modified to answer yes as opposed to no, is have that dealt with on tally, you know, where we look at some language and work on it together collectively, and then we could adopt it.
I would be happy with that, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, we could do that if the requester would be amenable to a brief extension.
It's great that Mr. Engel is in our midst and could perhaps provide us that time to do it on tally. Well, then, as I understand it, Commissioner Von Spakovsky has moved to approve agenda document number 06-37, except that on page 4, line 15, the term create will be replaced with author. And with respect to question number 4, beginning on page 6 of the draft, the answer be revised from no to yes, with a rationale to be circulated and approved on tally.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
Motion carries by a vote of 4-2. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, Mason, Toner, and the Vice Chairman voting affirmatively. Commissioners Weintraub and Walther voting no. That concludes our advisory opinions today. Mr. Costa, are there any administrative matters to bring to our attention today?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned.